everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of This Anthropological Life. As always, I'm Anil Tripathi.
I'm Adam Gamwell.
I'm Amy Haynes.
I'm Ryan Collins.
And today we're going into a case that's really been everywhere in social media lately, and for a very good reason. You know, August 9th this summer, Michael Brown was shot dead in Ferguson, Missouri, by police officer Darren William. And there's, you know, been a huge amount of publicity and social media response to this occurrence. It's brought up a lot of issues with the police force, structures of race and inequality in the United States. And so we really felt, you know, this issue deserves a lot of introspection and reflection. So we're really diving into that today on This Anthropological Life. And so with us today, we have Delon Justinville, and Amy will be introducing him.
Okay, welcome, Delon.
Cool. Thank you for having me on today. Very excited to be here.
Great. So I wanted to talk a little bit about your background and then why we wanted to invite you to be part of the conversation today. So Delon is the academic administrator for the Department of African and Afro-American Studies at Brandeis. He engages in biological anthropology, and he's worked as a lab assistant for a bioanthropology experiment at Harvard and as a teaching assistant and lab assistant for Brandeis's osteology course. So very experienced, definitely in the anthropology sphere of things, but also we wanted to invite you today for two reasons. The first one, I think, because of how you've been engaging with social media. We're linked up on social media on different sites, and you have posted quite a bit about it, as have I, and your posts are, I'd say, sort of large in scope. They're about bigger picture things, but they're also laced with personal sentiment, I think, and they're complex and, I think, important. And so I thought you would make our conversation much richer today if you were here. Also, with your position in the AAAS program here at Brandeis, I thought we could talk a little bit about what the faculty have been saying about this issue in terms of what the Academy's role should be and how they want to do, if they want to do anything, and if so, how. So I thought we'd start off today talking a little bit about Michael Brown, actually, because as time gets further from the event, he's starting to represent things. He's starting to represent racial inequality, you know, bigger conversations about militarization of the police, about police brutality, and we'll touch on all those things. But I think it's important for us to talk about him and to start with him. And I think a place for us to start is talking about where sort of the legal proceedings are right now and what people are talking about. And it seems to be there's huge focus on what happened between Darren Wilson and Michael Brown. And there's not video of it. So people are trying to piece these moments together. And they have eyewitnesses with conflicting accounts, community members saying different things, police officers saying different things. And so I know that the two things that I saw most recently were related to Michael Brown's size and whether or not he could be, you know, could pose an imminent threat, and if a person's size can be considered an imminent threat to someone like a police officer. And around that issue, a rebuttal to that was the publishing of Darren Williams' wedding photos. And the people who published his wedding photos were commenting on how tall he was and that he was comparable in size to Darren Wilson, or excuse me, to Mike Brown. And then another thing that I saw was lawsuits have been filed. This just came out in the news yesterday. Lawsuits have been filed to try to ascertain Mike Brown's, if he has a juvenile criminal record, and those files are not available to the public in Missouri. And so his family's attorney is refusing to engage with that issue. But what we see is different groups gathering these disparate pieces of information and all of this supposition to see what happened in a matter of, how long was it? Was it seconds?
Seconds.
Was it a minute? They're trying to piece together these few seconds and you know, those few seconds are, you know, what has the whole world talking about this issue right now. So I thought maybe we could jump in right there. Does anybody want to tag off of that, or...
Or Delana, do you want to give us some reflection also on these issues?
Well, one of the things that came up recently, well, with the within that time frame, was that Darren Wilson was attacked first. That's one of the allegations that first came out. And speaking on how we're trying to piece together what happened in just those mere seconds, since these reports had come out so quickly, he went to hiding the day after, and he released all these medical statements saying he was injured, he was bruised in the face, not in his collarbone, and one of the injuries that he claimed that he had from Michael Brown was a supraorbital fracture. As one who studies bones and such, there was no way that, and he people have seen pictures of his face, and there was no medical reports filed. There was no way that if you suffered from this kind of fracture, you can be visually in any semblance the same as you were before. The time it would take to heal and so on would just be months, even up to years. So
are you saying in that moment, if Michael Brown attacked Darren Wilson with such force that kind of fracture happened, would he immediately, it sounds like he would immediately be impaired?
Yes,
okay.
Exactly.
Okay.
He wouldn't have been able to see well enough to have shot him six times, nor would he have been able to go into hiding without having gone to a hospital. And there are no medical records of him having been injured or even entering any hospital facility in the nearby area. So that's one point I've been seeing, how they're trying so hard to recreate, at least in his defense, what is happening there, that they're reaching with, like, baseless right. accusations.
It's really challenging too. I mean, one of the things also that struck me about this is when they brought in Michael Baden, the New York autopsy examiner. He's famous for the kind of work that he does. And he's done three separate autopsies on Michael Brown for the family, for law enforcement, as well as for some other medical coroners. And like even that, again, what was important about that is he's the one that found the six bullet wounds. So he confirmed that Michael Brown was shot six times and then, but could not tell whether what else the body had been doing, if he had his hands up, if he was on his knees, if he was running or what, you know. So this, again, even though we had evidence of sort of how basically he was, you can call it how he was murdered or how he was taken down or whatever verb you want to use for that, it's really challenging too, because even this, like, we only get these partial pieces of information, right? And so even when talking about Michael Brown, as you said, Amy, you raised really interesting points of, like, what kinds of things are people trying to figure out? How tall was he, right? Why would a juvenile record help figure out, you know, this kind of, you know, these, how do these pieces fit together,
moment.
Right?
Yeah,
this particular moment. And it's really interesting. That's one of the issues, you know, that we can dive into a little later in the episode, too, but these notions of trust, right? Because when we're talking about legal cases like this, particularly ones that, like, you're talking about Ferguson, Missouri, that have a lot of racial tensions coming to the fore. In that, again, because, I mean, the story of this is, right, that Michael Brown was an African-American that was shot by a white police officer, and that's an issue we'll have to dive into here in a minute. But, like, the idea of the issues of trust are not there, partly because, again, when legal enforcement is trying to do things, they cannot give all the information. And they've even said this. Jay Nixon, who's the governor of Missouri, even kind of pointed out, like, well, we can't give you everything to the public. We can't give everything to everybody. Particularly, again, the records that have to do with Darren Wilson, the police officer, they can't give away everything that they don't. His testimony is not publicly known right now because the investigation is going on, right? So obviously, as we're saying, like, we do get, I mean, for lack of a better term, allegations or hearsay on both sides, talking for Michael, talking for Darren, about, you know, sort of what took place. And it's really interesting that you point out that issues like trying to get a juvenile record, we're looking at height comparatively from wedding photos, even, which is very curious. It's almost like anonymous is like hopping in, like hacking in, pulling out weird pictures, you know.
I think what's incredible here is the power of visuality in this whole discussion, especially through social media and through the media portrayal. I think, you know, your point, Delon, that you could tell kind of the fictitious nature of the story, right, immediately based on what you know from kind of what the record would be, the bone impact, and then what the images would be, and the lack of correlation. And I think, you know, and going back to these wedding photos also, right, there's this visuality involved, as well as in the video that was released by the police department, where they said, you know, this video shows, you know, Michael Brown stealing. But then
his
it really showed
mind,
him.
I think.
Oh, yeah, and it really showed him paying for the cigars, right?
Yeah.
So it's fascinating just how visual evidence has entered into to the betrayal of this issue, I think. And there was a really fascinating hashtag on Twitter, which picture would they use, right, if they gunned me down? And I think it is such a kind of poignant example of the power of what images we select to portray.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a lot of discussion initially of, you know, how they're portraying Michael Brown, right, with what photographs they use. Would they use a graduation picture or a picture of him in a, you know, in a you know, another kind of clothing and all that. So it has an incredibly powerful effect.
Mm-hmm. Anil, have you looked at many of those pictures that have been posted or people are talking about? Can you describe for our listeners any of them?
Yeah. Well, the pictures that people are posting on the Twitter account, which picture would they use? You know, they show a picture that's, you know, of them looking very proper and, you know, well-dressed, or a picture of them, you know, just, you know, the day-to-day life almost, right? You know,
right.
Kind of a selfie picture, unprofessional, maybe, you know, just kind of posing, goofing around, that kind of thing. So, you know, it shows how, depending on which picture you use, you can make a person look totally different. You know, they can be a serious or, you know, an upstanding member of society, or they can be, you know, just kind of a goofball or
right.
not a serious person.
Many of these photos that you're talking about have shown individuals at parties, usually with an alcoholic beverage in hand or smoking something, whether it's a cigarette or it's marijuana. And, you know, this could be relatively innocuous. It doesn't actually say anything about the person, but in a public light, it makes them look, it looks like they could be more of a criminal type. And then they show that juxtaposed to a picture of, like, a graduation or a more formal type of setting with family members and that type of thing. And it's really unfair to use these images that could be captured of anyone at any good time.
Yeah.
That are trying to direct people's attention to, of course, that person would be a criminal. Well, it's
right.
entirely false.
We mentioned in our last episode on relatedness and difference, we talked sort of about phrenology and, like, the idea of, like, pre-Franz Boas, when they would use skulls to say what people had, the skull looked more criminal-like.
Right.
In the 1860s, right? And actually, even the rise of photography itself was used on criminals first. Like, the idea of, like, the idea of this person looks more criminal-like, which is really interesting. I mean,
right.
so obviously that's in some ways both devolved and evolved till now. And I mean, like, the idea of, I think why this hashtag is so interesting and why Twitter is so useful in this capacity is because it is pointing out that, you know, there is a bias in how photographs and how visuality is used in this case. Like, I mean, the wedding photo is really a fascinating case too, you know, not like, particularly if we're talking about size, like, can you size somebody up in a photograph?
Mm-hmm.
Like, does that mean
would
they're more threatening? Would it be a
yeah.
fair fight?
Yeah.
Because, I mean,
yeah.
I mean, again, it's like, you know, Chewbacca or Han Solo. Like, Chewbacca's 7'6", so it's this kind of thing of, like, oh, he'd be more threatening, right? But that's not necessarily fair. If Han Solo's got the gun, then, you know, it's very different, you know? So it's like, it's these issues of, like, the picture can tell a certain kind of thing, you know, but obviously it's trying to tell a certain narrative, right?
Exactly.
So what all this information is trying to get at, you know, a clip here, photos there, they're trying to get at intention is what I how
yeah,
I read it. They're trying to get at Darren Wilson's intention behind shooting six times, I guess, and where he shot too, because that's very relevant. But, you know, he is of, I don't know if elite is the right word, but a certain class, you know, police officers in the state are, they do have the right to kill, you know? And so what was his intention? Did he have right intentions when he killed? Or did he have wrong intentions? And I guess if he had right intentions, maybe you'd use the verb kill. If he had wrong intentions, you'd use the verb murder. And so this really seems to hinge on, you know, trying to read the intentions of these two men in a matter of seconds.
Right. But even with that being said, we have to think about where Michael Brown was shot. And there have been conflicting reports on this, some that he was shot twice in the head. I mean,
yeah, there are photos posted online of the autopsy drawing.
Yeah.
And I think it was three times in the head, two in the head, four in the body. Okay.
Yeah. And with that being said, a police officer, if they're coming into contact with somebody, should be shooting to incapacitate, not shooting to kill.
Exactly.
And with two shots in the head, two bullets in the head, there was clear intent that he wanted this individual dead.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think anyone is going to argue otherwise with that.
It's an incredible thing. I think when we think about the use of force, right, and, you know, what's a valid response from the police, and we've seen it, you know, come up also with the protests that happened afterwards and with the vigils, and just how I think the most shocking images, right, were this tremendous use of force. And then it goes back to, you know, asking the question, you know, why do the police have all of this military equipment? Why do they have these tanks and whatnot? And, of course, this harkens back to almost kind of an economic system in our society, right, where the government and the military sell weaponry at incredibly discounted prices to local police departments, where they can get equipment that might be worth hundreds of thousands of dollars for thousands. You know, it's heavily discounted, and they're almost encouraged to apply. It's similar in so many branches of government, where if you don't get the grants out and get funding, then you get your funding cut back. Right, so you're almost required to take on these weapons. Mm-hmm. And then it's created this situation, right, where there's just such a stark contrast between, I think, what we think would be an expected response and what has been happening in Ferguson.
There's a lot of talk on Twitter, too, about, or there are a lot of veterans who are critiquing what's happening in Ferguson and how much the police there look like military. And some of them have said, you know, they've been trained not to point a weapon at a person unless they intend to shoot it at them. And we see, you know, these harrowing images of Ferguson police with these guns raised on top of tanks. You know, there's one photo of, I think it's a young woman, and she's standing there with her hands up, and there's just a gaggle of police officers with guns pointed at her. And it really kind of sums up the situation there. And there, a vet from the Air Force, his name's James Schuyler Gerond, on Twitter, he said the first lesson of crowd and riot control training that they did every year was that your mere presence has the potential to escalate the situation. And so visually seeing these officers in riot gear, how that can up the ante.
Right. And it's riot gear on top of camouflage. They really do look militarized. Like, this looks like an actual war going on. And another issue, again, like you were saying, Amy, with the guns being raised and pointed, the police have their fingers on the triggers. Mm-hmm. Like, they are ready to go. And that's not part of military training. You do not raise the gun. You do not have your finger on the trigger unless you plan to shoot the gun.
Mm-hmm.
And this is entirely absurd.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of military training, I know the tear gassing, it's illegal in martial law, there's no regulation for it in its usage in for like local police.
Mm-hmm.
However, it is illegal to shoot tear gas directly into a crowd or directly at somebody. You're supposed to shoot it on the ground and have it roll in that direction. So I find it interesting that there are these stipulations and laws in place, but people have to follow them, but the people who are supposed to be enforcing them don't have to or aren't.
Mm-hmm.
Or the militarization of the police, how much artillery they have and the armored vehicles and the camouflage.
Mm-hmm.
The stipulation for getting these grants to fund these are that you are only supposed to use them in instances of war on terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
Like, these large amounts of grants were given out after 9/11 to these local police departments to then fund the acquisition of these materials. So is Ferguson now a war zone? Because you're not supposed to use these unless it's a war is breaking out. So
I'm going to go out on a limb and say part of the reason, and this isn't a limb, and people are talking about this, part of the reason that the response has been so big from the police is because they're dealing with a largely black community, you know, and it's what's fueling these images of Michael Brown are all of the stereotypes, you know, that have been with the U.S. since slavery about black men as violent, you know. And so I know it's interesting because these aren't the words that I've seen newscasters use, but these two groups are getting raced, I think, implicitly in people's conversations. So the rioters, you know, whether that's looters or protesters, are all getting lumped together in sort of common parlance, and they are raced as black. And the cops, I think, we're seeing this image of Darren Wilson all over the place. And I know that the police commissioner in this area talked about there is some diversity, that they're not an all-white police force, very small amount. But I think the police are coming across as white.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm at a loss because I don't know how horrible this is. That I don't know what to say. I don't know what to say about it.
It's terrible. But not all the people, like you're saying, are just in these binary categories here. There are so many different people protesting. I mean, Newsweek was talking about how there's a Holocaust survivor has been arrested in Ferguson for aiding in the protesting because she feels that this is entirely ludicrous.
I think it's one of the challenges too, because as we're seeing is that like there are and there's again different forms of protesters too. Here we're talking. I mean, like there's an interesting article in Time magazine called "The Tragedy of Ferguson" by Don Van Driel and Alex Altman. And one of the things that struck me about this piece they're talking about is like there is obviously this issue of mistrust between police and citizenry,
right.
And on top of that, there is sort of this like third group, which is part of the citizenry, but these sort of community volunteers that are trying to keep the peace from the certain protesters that are like want to throw bottles, that want to incite riots. Other protests don't. And as you're saying, I mean, like this problem is like when we're talking about these major, these mega groups of police and citizenry, they do get lumped together, and that gets racialized. And so it's like this dually hard, you know, thing to sort of decipher. And I think that's why I think we're all a little bit at a loss for words there, because it's like, how do we untangle this web? Because there's super high tensions. There's potential for extreme violence. There's obviously racial issues. There is issues of social justice and social inequality here, right? And whether it's prison populations or sort of how different citizens are treated. And then, of course, even how different people are choosing to protest. I mean, one of the things that really struck me also, again, this timepiece, is that community organizers are the ones that are picking up the tear gas canisters. Police aren't even cleaning up their own shit. Like, other people are coming in to take care of this stuff. And, like, that's a problem. You know, like, this is not an easy thing, right? Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, this being this anthropological life, the value of having a perspective from anthropology on this issue is to see these multi-layers, right? And see how many different social movements had to happen even before this incident for this to occur. I mean, with Ferguson, you have issues of white flight, where you had a majority white population that became a majority black population fairly quickly, right? And this white police force, which this dichotomy really is a layover from that, right, where the population changed, but the administration didn't. And you have, you know, the mayor of Ferguson, the vast majority of the council, all being white members. So it's this extreme divide, right, where you have this bureaucratic authority, state authority, just all, you know, it's basically without any representation from the local community.
In terms of talking about how these two groups are being raced or about how violent the police are, quotes from some of the police officers are amazing. One was to a journalist, an officer in Ferguson said, "I will fucking kill you." And then to the whole crowd, and this officer has since been suspended, he was quoted as saying, "Bring it, you fucking animals," screaming that into the crowd. And
I find it interesting, speaking of the racing of these two groups.
Yeah.
So you just spoke of the incredible violence, even the verbal violence alone, much less the physical violence from the police. So the majority of the citizens right now are peaceful protesters. But there's a minority of them who did the alleged looting. And the majority of the police force right now is being violent, but they are being pictured as the peaceful ones. The majority who's doing the peaceful protesting is being depicted as violent, and the majority who's doing these violent acts are being depicted as peaceful. And I think that plays a lot into the racing of the two groups and playing into respectability politics, which...
Why do we think that this is happening now? Why Michael Brown and not Trayvon? I mean, people spoke up for Trayvon Martin and people protested around it, but it wasn't... We did not see the response that we're seeing here. And not just at Trayvon, you know, there was Amadou Diallo in New York. Mm-hmm. There was Sean Bell back in 2006. I'm getting some of these names from this really startling, I don't know what you call it. It's not a meme, but this set of images and quotes going around, and it's young black men who've been killed in the past, you know, 5, 6, 7 years, and they're quoting the last phrase that they said before they were shot and killed. Oscar Grant from 2009 said, "You shot me, you shot me." Kendrick Madade from 2012, Why Did You Shoot Me? You know, there are a ton of these here. Amadou Diallo in 1999, his last words before being shot and killed were, "Mom, I'm going to college." And so, Kimberly Gray in 2013 said, "Please don't let me die," before dying. And so, with all of this happening, why do we think the Ferguson response is so big, and these past ones haven't been so big?
I personally think it's like a build-up. Like, mm-hmm. all these things happened. The MSNBC reported that between 2006 and 2012, the amount of black people killed by either police officers or state-sanctioned or community-identified safekeepers averages up to about 2 people of color per week for a 6-year span. And so the response to the Trayvon Martin killing last year was huge.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel after this 6-year period and after that, this was just, you know, like it popped the bottle. Like,
mm-hmm.
there was just so much pressure being built up that this just,
mm-hmm.
there's no more ability to contain it or to
mm-hmm.
be quiet about it or to, okay, well, if we calm down and just reflect
mm-hmm.
on this, maybe it won't happen again.
Not just fear, or not just anger, but fear too.
Mm-hmm.
I'm seeing a lot of my friends who are parents, particularly moms, asking what they should be telling their sons of color. You know, do you tell them not to trust the police? Do you safety plan with them? Do you try to figure out how to identify a trustworthy versus an untrustworthy, you know, police officer? But also, I too wanted to get in, Delon, what is happening right now with the AAAS program at Brandeis? What, if anything, have the faculty been talking about doing, about how have they been talking about using classroom discussion or not, you know, in this fall semester?
Well, we had a meeting about it a few weeks ago. Well, as before the semester even began, we called a department meeting, but just a huge chunk of us spent just talking about this. Each one of the AAAS faculty and even affiliates have altered their syllabi so that within these first 2 weeks, they're immediately addressing.
Wow.
For example, Faith Smith is offering a class on globalization, sexuality of Caribbean women,
mm-hmm.
and somehow she has, in her genius ways, she has found out how to tie Ferguson into the globalization and diasporic treatment of people of color around the world.
Mm-hmm.
Professor Williams is teaching Introduction to African American History and African American Studies. That's, well, of course,
mm-hmm.
you can incorporate that. Jasmine Johnson, who's teaching a class on black performance, is she's actually the one who brought up in this meeting of respectability politics and Cosbyisms, and that's
mm-hmm.
what she's teaching on, how there's this myth of, if you perform black properly, bad things won't happen to you.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what she has changed.
And Cosby is the right way to perform
like,
blackness.
This doctor, this lawyer, look, they're successful, they do nothing wrong, they dress
mm-hmm.
properly, bad things don't happen to them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so
mm-hmm.
that's what she's teaching on. But moreover, we're trying to construct this Black Lives Matter week, and we decided to approach it from the notion of Black Lives Matter being the AAAS department instead of end police brutality or stop militarization. But we're incorporating all these different themes that this Ferguson situation has erupted into this week. It's still in the planning process because the beginning of the school year is very hectic and difficult, but we are being relentless. And if you guys are following on Twitter, social media, the hashtag the Ferguson syllabus that this professor at Georgetown University created. Her name slips me at this moment, but she created, and it's one of our affiliates, Lori Nasai Jefferson in Heller.
Mm-hmm.
She has taken this syllabus and another one crowdsourced by the Council on African American Policy,
mm-hmm.
I believe that's what they're called, and she's compiled this, God, maybe 12-page resource booklet that includes
mm-hmm.
all these different compilations of Ferguson syllabi,
wow.
Audiovisual media publishings that relate to and that inform
mm-hmm.
Discussions that have resulted as a form of this,
mm-hmm.
as a result of this rioting and protesting and the killing of Mike Brown. So we are doing a lot,
mm-hmm.
but
mm-hmm.
it's so much that we have to, that organizing it and putting it out is where we are currently.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we see that there's nothing needs to be done, and we're trying to involve more
mm-hmm.
departments and more people, high administration on campus.
It's So the Academy is creating spaces for conversation, giving
yes.
people as many resources as possible to get at all these the different angles of the situation and situations like it. They're addressing the emotional components, like you said, with vigils. And I think this idea of Black Lives Matter is pretty amazing. And so it sounds like you're trying to shape a conversation, you know, around what we can do and what we should be doing instead of what police should not be doing, which is implicit in what we should be doing, you know, this critique of what's wrong. But it really is a different approach than, like, post-colonial studies and things like that.
I think really, you know, bringing these issues up and really kind of thinking hard about it is very important in open discussion, right? Especially where you have other, you know, even the public school system where they've been ordered not to talk about Ferguson, right? You have the case in Edwardsville, Illinois, a school district 25 miles from Ferguson, where teachers have been told to avoid the subject altogether, and that Ferguson isn't an open discussion, isn't open for discussion because the shooting is a situation where many facts are unknown, right, according to the superintendent of that school district. So I think with all this, right, especially with kind of the media spread of information, it's fascinating how it's portrayed, right? And it can be either so people, you know, will respond to it in a variety of ways. They can either, you know, open up these discussions or, you know, there's plenty of room where they can also just close it completely. Based on how they craft it, right? And there's so many ways to make a response seem legitimate, right, based off of information.
It makes me think, I mean, Tom Tyler is a professor at Yale, and he basically works on issues of public trust. And that's, I mean, that's one of the issues that, since we've been, a lot of things we've been hinting at is, like, again, this, the partial nature of the information, A, from what happened, and then also we're talking about, like, what's a good way to respond or a bad way to respond, right? Like, whether it's police behaving badly or how to, like, have a really great visual, which actually, I think there's one tomorrow, isn't there, here at Brandeis, if you're in the area, September 4th, I think it's 7 to 10 p.m.
Yes.
But on top of this question that Tom Tyler looks at is that what I appreciate, he says, we need to take distrust seriously here, because this is one of the issues of talking about response, is that there's distrust at least on many sides here, right? And I think what the work that AAAS is doing is awesome in terms of, like, gathering these so many kinds of resources, whether it is sort of a vigil, whether it is a incorporating it into syllabi in classes or taking actually the Ferguson syllabus itself, which is a very cool idea, actually. Mm-hmm. I'm glad that they have such resources available. Or, again, pointing out, like you said, in Illinois, that they're not supposed to talk about it in a public space. And so I think that the idea of taking distrust seriously is an important part of this, right? In that, because, again, looking at the idea of how does public trust work, particularly in a case like this, which has so much tension, is that, again, Tyler says, and actually pointed this out before, Amy, that, like, obviously just the mere presence of police can escalate a situation, can move it more towards violence and then sort of, you know, promoting peace. And one of the main ways that Tyler points out, just it sounds so simple, though, in terms of, like, promoting trust, is beginning with respect, right? And that's one of the things I think that we're seeing a lot of this is lacking in the police case, right? And that's sort of, I think, what AAAS we're trying to recapture, right? In the Ferguson syllabus, too, let's recapture that, the air of respect, and let's think about, like, distrust is part of this. There's a racial narrative. There is a social inequality narrative here. But we need to approach this with respect, and that's, I think, one of the pieces that, like, seems to be missing that Tom Tyler helped me think about, right? We're saying, how do we rebuild, right, in some ways, right? How do we move forward? And the idea is, like, finding simple ways of beginning with trust, you know? And, I mean, my hope is, of course, you know, we work in an academy, and that we can, like, use this medium, right, in productive ways. And I think that the stuff you're talking about in AAAS Delon sounds really great, because it is these different public venues of trying to sort of build respect into many different ways of engaging. But taking seriously that there is distrust everywhere, right?
Right.
And indeed, you know, so, you know, there's some hope.
Yeah. To tag on to that, to the idea of distrust, I want to add danger. Because I think there need to be really serious conversations about how dangerous it is for young Black men, and if we need to start safety planning with them. You know, my background was in working at a domestic violence agency, and safety planning was the number one service we could provide to victims of domestic violence. You know, how do you try to stay safe how do you try to stay as safe as possible when violence is escalating, not just preventing it in the moment? And so I don't know. I would like to see something like that, you know, in terms of when you say Black Lives Matter, that's a wonderful slogan. And part of, you know, that in my mind is trying to make young Black men young men of color as safe as possible. You know, those lives do matter. Let's give them some concrete tools to stay safe. Mm-hmm. While we are critiquing what the police are doing, what everybody's doing, there's a practical side of all of this, too.
Yeah, it's a great point.
I think, you know, something that's really important to think about with regards to all these responses is also that, you know, just with how much media involvement always, I think, kind of hovers around the Black community almost. You know, everything, there's so many images of what it is to be Black in the U.S. and so many stereotypes and racializations mm-hmm. that I think it's so important to continually try to keep the conversation opened up to prevent it from being kind of sidelined into a category. I mean, I was just looking up on Fox News in response to them, you know, hearing about curriculums being developed to discuss about Ferguson. They immediately compared it to the Black Panthers and this kind of, you know, and their agendas, right? And so immediately, right, if you're coming from a conservative background in the U.S., you hear Black Panther.
And it's over
becomes
for you.
A fear.
The conversation's
exactly.
over.
So I think it's really important to think about how we can stop these conversations from being co-opted by the general media, right? And
absolutely.
Put into these, you know, two easily simplified categories that just engender this fear and kind of distrust amongst communities.
I think it also plays into the targeting of, you say, how we want to, how can we build modules and build methods for how we want to stay safe against this violence, but how can you even begin to construct these if the violence is targeted at you to begin with?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And if it's the people who are supposed to protect you.
Right, because there needs to be true systemic change. Because
mm-hmm.
if we're looking at police forces that are corrupt and that are targeting you know, peoples of color simply because they want to, or they have a bias towards it, or what have you. And these biases exist outside of Ferguson in several areas.
Mm-hmm.
Even here in Boston.
Definitely.
A friend of mine was in my car one night, and we were pulled over by a policeman. He was sitting in the back seat, and he was given a ticket. The police officer told me to have a nice day, sir, and kindly walked away after giving my friend a ticket for not having his seatbelt on.
Oh, yeah. And we see, you know, just with Darren Wilson's former police force, it was actually disbanded for excessive force and corruption.
Oh,
right. So this is a background where you see there are some serious issues to be dealt with within this police department.
Mm-hmm.
I think part two of why, you know, people who are calling out for support of Darren Wilson, who are trying to raise funds for him, there's been almost $500,000 raised for him. People who sort of who don't buy into the fact that there is extreme injustice, like, made real right in front of us, I think something that they miss is that when you say race is involved, it doesn't necessarily have to be Darren Wilson thinking, I want to shoot this man because he is Black. You know, it is not always that overt. It can be as small as when he has to react in a moment, reacting more violently maybe than he would with someone else. It might not even be conscious,
right?
But the fact that it is a Black man that he's engaged with in that moment, maybe that means that he shoots in the head, you know, instead of the leg,
right?
Maybe because Black men are scary, you know,
right.
And Black men are dangerous.
And it's
a
split-second decision, right? And so much of our kind of our racial biases are actually kind of almost biologically ingrained through culture. You have
what do you mean?
So we've
like
had
biological natural?
Oh, yeah. No, not biological. Like, it's like, so there have been studies that have asked people who, you know, identify themselves as not being racist, as being open,
mm-hmm.
and they've seen their reactions when a person of color walks by. They've actually recorded, you know, seen what their nervous
mm-hmm.
system reaction is. And they have a reaction, right?
Yeah.
Even
yeah.
if they're not cognizant of it. And they don't express it.
You're talking about white folks.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, you know, incredibly powerful, especially if you think about a situation where that kind of a person has a gun.
Mm-hmm.
Even
yeah.
if they
yeah.
profess, you know, non-racist beliefs,
mm-hmm.
they still might, because of this kind of ingraining in our society almost.
Right.
I think of this image of the, you know, of scary.
He's up against
people of color.
Dangerous Black masculinity,
yeah.
you know?
And this is definitely a huge possibility. What we need then are some sort of programs for handling weapons better. The answer to this is not the traditional American answer of we need more guns. More guns, more things like militarization with tanks and Black Hawk helicopters that some towns now have for their regular police forces. That's too much. We don't need all of that. I mean, there are other systems of policing throughout the world that do fine jobs without guns.
Mm-hmm. I would play devil's advocate a little there, Ricky Ryan. I don't know that we need to learn. Police officers, they do need, you know, learning how to handle a gun more safely sounds like a good idea to me anytime. But they know how to handle guns safely when they shoot a white suspect in the leg or the arm. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know if it's about, you know, he wasn't safe with his gun in the moment. That is definitely a question if they were tussling over the gun and where the gun was. But I think it's a race issue first and foremost.
No, I mean that as a race issue. I'm saying training to go against your instincts, which might, you know,
when it comes to facing like a black subject,
exactly.
Or a
not simply just
Latino
shooting
subject.
Or learning how to use the weapon, but
suspect.
In different situations, we need situational type of procedures that can help avoid incidences like these, because nobody wants to see more of this.
And I think one of the real things that, to me, I think this incident shows at the end of the day is that people need to live together. I mean, if you have racially segregated communities, I don't think this is ever going to end.
Mm-hmm.
We need people, you know, to live in mixed communities where there are people of color, white people, you know, just where everyone is mixed. And the problem is now we're living in a society that's increasingly segregated.
Yeah.
You know, looking at the aftermath of Brand versus Board of Education, we have even more segregated schools where the majority are Latino and black population. So it's a very scary trajectory in this country, I think, that hopefully we can move past.
Exactly. And it's unfortunate that Ferguson is such a microcosm for all these different racial tensions and issues that
really
are happening
is,
around the country. And it's unfortunately, it's a really good topic to focus on, because we can look at all this stuff and hopefully use these type of bad situations to push towards better futures. And that's why we need to keep spreading these words about cultures, are really just focusing on cultural issues within this country. They're addressing these racial divides, and hopefully we can start to bridge the tension by being open about this.
And making Black Lives Matter, to use the AAAS departments. I think that's a
exactly.
wonderful slogan, and I'm excited to see what comes out of it. And I want to thank Delon for joining us today. You definitely made the conversation richer, having someone with a background in biological anthropology and with a foot in the academy, with a department that's trying to directly address this, is a really great thing. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Good being here.
Well, this is TAL Episode 1 of Season 4 signing off. I'm Ryan Collins.
I'm Amy Haynes.
And I'm Anil Tripathi.
We'll catch you next week.
Bye-bye. Thank you.